Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info. The account of Yosef seems larger than life as it is. His coat of many colors, his dreams of greatness over his older brothers and even his parents, his being sold by those brothers into slavery in Mitzrayim, then rising from prison to vice president of the mighty ancient empire that built the pyramids. But that's for a later discussion. This time, Hallel Fellowship teacher Daniel explores a messianic play in the Torah reading Vayeshev, which means he settled. It covers Genesis chapters 37 through 40. Yosef was playing the role of Mashiach consistently through his life. His father Yaakov played God the Father. Older brother Yehuda played the leadership of the people of Israel. And brother Reuben also has a prophetic role. There are also two different harlots in this story. One is righteous, Tamar, and one is evil, Potiphar's wife. Through it all, we see that God is the one in control of all things, not Yehuda. Mashiach hadn't yet become flesh, yet we read all about him in Yosef's life.
We are in our next parasha section, which is Vayeshev, which is the section which we discuss and learn about Joseph. So we'll be covering Genesis 37 through 40 for our Torah reading section. We will also, for our Haftorah reading, if I get there, I should be able to. We'll all see if all goes well. Covering Amos, not the whole entire book, of course, but just Amos chapter 2, through most chapter 2, starting in verse 6, through chapter 3, verse 8. The Haftorah section, of course, naturally, corresponds to some of the details which we're learning in Genesis. So starting out in Genesis chapter 37. Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Jacob. Joseph, at the age of 17 years, was a shepherd with his brothers for the flock. But he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph would bring evil reports about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, since he was a child of his old age. And he made him a fine woolen tunic. His brothers saw that it was he whom their father loved most of all his brothers, so they hated him. They could not speak to him peaceably. Joseph dreamt a dream, which he told his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear, if you please, this dream which I dreamt. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the middle of this field, when, behold, my sheaf rose and also remained standing. And then, behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Would you then reign over us? Would you then dominate us?" And they hated him even more, because of his dreams and because of his talk. He dreamt another dream and related it to his brothers, and he said, "Look, I dreamt another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." He related it to his father and to his brothers. His father scolded him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamt? Are we to come, I and your mother and your brothers, to bow down to you to the ground?" So his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers went to the pasture of their flock, their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Your brothers are pasturing in Shechem, are they not? Come, I will send you to them." He said to him, "Here I am." And he said to him, "Go now, look at the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring me back word." So he sent him from the depths of Hebron, and he arrived at Shechem. A man discovered him, and behold, he was blundering in the field. The man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" He said, "My brothers do I seek. Please tell me, where are they pasturing?" The man said, "They have journeyed on from here, for I heard them saying, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and when he had not yet approached them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Look, that dreamer's coming. So now, come, let us kill him, Throw him into one of these pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then we shall see what has become of his dreams. Reuben heard and rescued him from their hand. He said, we will not strike him mortally. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, intending to rescue him from their hand to return him to his father. And so it was, when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the fine woolen tunic that was on him. They took him and cast him into the pit. The pit was empty. No water was in it. They sat to eat food. They raised their eyes, and they saw, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, their camels bearing spices, balsam, and lotus, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, what gain is there if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, but let our hand not be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. His brothers agreed. Midianite men, traders, passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. Then they brought Joseph to Egypt. Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he rent his garments. Returning to his brothers, he said, the boy is gone, and I, where can I go? They took Joseph's tunic, they slaughtered a goatling, and dipped the tunic in the blood. They dispatched the fine woolen tunic, and they brought it to their father. And they said, we found this. Identify it, if you please. Is it your son's tunic or not? He recognized it and said, my son's tunic, a savage beast devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to bits. Then Jacob rent his garments and put sackcloth on his loins. He mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted himself. He said, for I will go down to the grave mourning for my son. And his father bewailed him. Now the Midianites had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh, the chamberlain of the butchers. Chapter 38. It was at this time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned away towards an old Adullamite man whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a prominent merchant whose name was Shua. He married her and consorted with her. She conceived and bore a son. He called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son. She called his name Onan. And yet again, and she bore a son, and called his name Shelah. And it was in Heseb when she bore him. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the eyes of the Lord. And the Lord caused him to die. Then Judah said to Onan, consort with your brother's wife, enter into interlivate marriage with her, and establish offspring for your brother. But Onan knew the seed would not be his, so it was that whenever he would consort with his brother's wife, he would let it go to waste on the ground, so as not to provide offspring for his brother. What he did was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and he caused him to die also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, lest he also die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Many days passed, and Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. When Judah was consoled, he went up to oversee the sheep shearers, he and his Adullamite friend Hira, to Timnah. And Tamar was told as follows, behold, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she removed her widow's garb from upon her, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself up. She then sat by the crossroads which is on the road toward Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown, and she had not been given to him as wife. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, since she had covered her face. So he detoured to her by the road and said, come, if you please, let me consort with you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me if you consort with me? He replied, I will send you a kid of the goats from the flock. She said, provided you leave a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet, your wrap, and your staff that is in your hand. And he gave them to her and consorted with her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and left and removed her veil from upon her, and she put on her widow's garb. Judah sent the kid of the goats through his friend, the Adullamite, to retrieve the pledge from the woman. But he did not find her. He inquired the people of her place, saying, "Where is the prostitute, the one at the crossroads by the road?" They said, "There was no prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her. Even the local men said there was no prostitute here." So Judah said, "Let her keep them, lest you become a laughingstock. I really sent her this kid, but you could not find her." And it was, when about 3 months had passed, that Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has committed a harlotry, and moreover, she is conceived by harlotry." Judah said, "Take her out, let her be burned." As she was taken out, she sent word to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Identify, if you please. Who's this signet, this wrap, and this staff?" Judah recognized, and he said, "She is right. It is from me, inasmuch as I did not give her to Shelah, my son." And he was not intimate with her again. It came to pass at the time she gave birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. And it happened that as she gave birth, one put out a hand. The midwife took a crimson thread and tied it on his hand, saying, "This one emerged first." And it was, as he drew his hand back in, that, behold, his brother emerged. And she said, "What with what strength you asserted yourself." And he called his name Perez. Afterward, his brother, on whose hand was the crimson thread, came out. He called his name Zerah. Chapter 39. And Joseph had been brought down to Egypt. Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh, the chamberlain of butchers, a prominent Egyptian, purchased him from the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he remained in the house of his Egyptian master. His brothers perceived the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made succeed in his hand. Joseph found favor in his eyes, and he attended him. He appointed him over his whole household, whatever he placed in his custody. And it happened that from the time he appointed him in his house over whatever he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on Joseph's account, so that the Lord's blessing was in whatever he owned. In the house and the field, he left all that he had in Joseph's custody, and with him present, he concerned himself with nothing except for the bread he ate. Now Joseph was handsome of form and handsome of appearance. After these things, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph. She said, "Lie with me." But he adamantly refused. He said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here, my master concerns himself about nothing in the house, and whatever he has placed in my custody. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has denied me nothing but you, since you are his wife. How then can I perpetrate this great evil and have sinned against God?" And so it was, as she coaxed Joseph day after day, so he would not listen to her or lie beside her to be with her. Then there was an opportune day when he entered the house to do his work, no man of the house staff being there in the house, that she caught hold of him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand, and he fled and went outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called out to the men of her household and spoke to them, saying, "Look, he brought us a Hebrew man to sport with us. He came to lie with me, but I called out with a loud scream. And when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside." She kept his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she told a similar account, saying, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came to me to sport with me. But it happened when I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and ran outside." And as was, when his master heard his wife's words, which she spoke to him, saying, "Your slave did things like this to me," his anger flared up. Joseph's master took him and placed him in the prison, for the place where the king's prisoners were confined. He remained there in prison. The Lord was with Joseph, and he endowed him with charisma, and he put his favor in the eyes of the prison warden. The prison warden placed all the inmates of the prison in Joseph's custody, and everything that was done there, he would accomplish. The prison warden did not scrutinize anything that was in his charge, inasmuch as the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made successful. Chapter 40. And it happened after these things. Hold on, excuse me. Thank you. It happened after these things that the cupbearer, the king of Egypt, and the baker transgressed against their master, against the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was enraged at his two courtiers, the chamberlain of the cupbearers and the chamberlain of the bakers. He placed them in the ward of the house of the chamberlain of the butchers, into the prison. And he placed where Joseph was confined. The chamberlain of the butchers appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them, and they remained in the ward for a period of days. The two of them dreamt a dream. Each one had his dream on the same night, each one according to the interpretation of his dream, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison. Joseph came to him in the morning. He saw them, and both they were aggrieved. He asked Pharaoh's courtiers, who were with him in the ward of his master's house, saying, "Why do you appear downcast today?" They said to him, "We dreamt a dream, but there is no interpretation, no interpreter for it." So Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Relate it to me, if you please." The chamberlain of the cupbearers recounted his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream, behold, there was a grapevine in front of me. On the grapevine were three tendrils, and it was as though it budded. Its blossoms, it bloomed, its clusters ripened all into grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup. I placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm." Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of your dream. The three tendrils were 3 days. In another 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and will restore you to your post, and you will place Pharaoh's cup in his hand, as was the former practice when you were his cupbearer. If only you would think of me with yourself when he benefits you, and you will do me kindness, if you please, and mention me to Pharaoh, then you would take me out of this building. For indeed I was kidnapped from the hand of the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing for them to have put me into the pit." The chamberlain of the bakers saw that he had interpreted well. So said to Joseph, "I too, in my dream, behold, there are three wicker baskets. They were on my head. In the uppermost basket, there were all kinds of Pharaoh's food, baker's handiwork. The birds were eating them from the basket above my head." Joseph responded and said, "This is its interpretation. Three baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head from you and hang you on a tree. The birds will eat your flesh from you." And it was on the 3rd day, Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all of his servants, and he counted the chamberlain of the cupbearers and the chamberlain of the bakers among his servants. He restored the chamberlain of the cupbearers to his cupbearing, and he placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm. But he hanged the chamberlain of the bakers. He hung just as Joseph had interpreted. Yet the chamberlain of the cupbearers did not remember Joseph, but he forgot him. So that's our Torah reading portion for the day. Before I go into any discussion about details, what happens, all that kind of stuff, are there any comments, questions, or things I can answer for you regarding this section? Yes, Alma.
Does the Bible say he brought evil reports?
We interpret the word, no offense to anyone, if you see it this way, as evil as being a very corrupt thing. It doesn't necessarily mean evil as in like there's corruption. Does evil mean that something bad has happened or something bad is happening? Either, for example, it is not evil against Joseph, but evil about his brothers, whatever they're doing. So if they were lazy, if they were neglecting, if they were destroying private property, if they were doing anything of that nature, that's the report he would send, that they're making mistakes. It's important that it's an evil report, because Messiah does it too for a different reason. We'll discuss that when we talk about him today. Messiah brings also an evil report to his father regarding what is going on in his time. It's important we note that, because this is heavily parallel with what Messiah is doing, because Joseph is playing Messiah's role. So the evil report is a big deal here. It's a bad report. It simply means that He's pointing out to Jacob, there are bad things happening amongst my brothers from the descendants of Bilhah and Zilpah. That those particular brothers, in particular, I don't know where Leah's brothers were at, or sons, sorry, were at, but those two was what the report was referring to. Whatever they were doing was not positive. We don't know the details. Now, I will say that in the blessings that Jacob gives to his sons, many chapters from now, there is some indication that there some of the evil things that they have done in those blessings. Not all of them, but a few of them. So the hamstringing of a donkey, for example, that's not a positive thing, but one of them gets, you know, dinged for that by their dad. The point is the dad knows about it. So we'll discuss that hopefully a little more later on today regarding what it means to have an evil report. Yes?
I noticed that with Potiphar.
Yes.
That they were, in the English translation, at least the one I have, they refer to both Potiphar and the jailer as captains of bodyguard, or captain of the bodyguard.
Yes, captain of the bodyguard.
But then when you look at it in the original Hebrew of those two folks, there's different terms.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Potiphar is, it also means that he might have been the, I've seen it phrased, a chief butcher, a cook, or something to do with food.
Yes.
But then with the jailer, it's more obviously bodyguard.
Yes.
You know, or
The distinction, what I have read, now I'm not saying this is absolutely true, but I've read that the jailer's job was also executioner. So the Potiphar being the chief butcher, chief food association to him, that he is probably, not necessarily true all the way, but probably associated with the slaughtering of animals, most likely. Food. Versus the jailer, whose job is not slaughtering of animals, but slaughtering of people. That's his job. They're both butchers. They're both the same grouping of each other. This is what they're butchering. It's just different. So that's the intent behind the imagery. We're supposed to imagine what this is like, what the jail is like in Egypt versus what it may be like in our modern day jails, which is not quite so, I guess, mortal. Usually. Any other comments or questions I can answer for you or talk about today? Yes.
The version that I have, just like you were reading, it says a coat of wool.
Right. Fine wool or many colors. Right.
Okay.
It's they don't know what it looked like. They don't know what it looked like. It could be anything. The many colors, it means it's a prominent or very fine or very nice. Because at that time, that culture, color was very rare. You don't have a lot of dyed things. Today, you go down to local, you know, dress shop, and you have imaginable colors are all over the place. Just everything you can imagine is all there. It's all polyester, most likely, but it's pre-colored, and it's already redone for you. The plastic just spits out the different colors you want. That's not the case then. Dye is very difficult and expensive to get a hold of. So being a fine wool tunic or fine wool garment, whatever it was most likely fine, meaning it was very nice, but probably also colored or decorative of some form. What that means, precisely how it looked like, we don't know. But it means a whole bunch, because that's exactly what God did with Messiah. Messiah was given a unique place. He was given a unique talent. The power of God was given to him, which makes him higher above all of his brothers, which is no different than Joseph being higher up than all of his brothers. Messiah was very well, he was poorly received at the time by his brethren, just as Joseph was poorly received by his brethren. Clearly God was blessing Messiah and Jacob was blessing Joseph, and the brothers didn't like it. So it is to grant the great power, or great authority, or great responsibility to a particular son. That's really its symbolism. So we should be seeing the same thing with Messiah in his life and how that worked. God did the same thing to him, because these are parallels. I have a little chart up here. Those of you can read it, that's great. My writing isn't, you know, really big, but Joseph is playing a messianic figure. It's important to remember that. So all this, the story, this whole cycle, he is playing out parts of Messiah's life and Messiah's imagery throughout. It's pretty consistent. Jacob in this story, for the most part, plays God himself. That's the role he's playing in this play. If you will, In this story where Judah shows up, he is playing the leadership or people of Israel. That's the character he is playing in this story. Judah is playing Israel's character. I'm making these references because, well, essentially that's what the Bible says. I mean, Amos says the exact same thing, that that's what's happening with Judah. He is playing Israel. And of course, Messiah is obviously doing the exact same that Joseph did. And Jacob's doing what God did with Messiah. So all these roles are very, very evident. You will also note as you go through this, the harlots, there are two of them. There's Tamar and then there's Potiphar's wife. Both were harlots in their different ways. They play two different types of people. We'll discuss that as well. There is the evil Egyptian harlot. There's also the righteous harlot, which Tamar was playing. We'll discuss what that means in a little while. You will also note in our story we've read that because Judah is playing Israel as a whole, Reuben, however, plays the proper or righteous counselor known as a prophet. We'll discuss a little bit about him. And of course, Joseph is the righteous one being accosted or sold. But what we have not read in this story, we did read it in chapter 39, but we'll discuss it, I'm sorry, 38, not 39. We'll discuss it again, but we won't, Jeff will, when Judah has to talk to Joseph, and Joseph reveals himself, and Judah's dumbfoundedly shocked, because guess who gets to go tell Dad? Hey, Dad, guess what I did? You want to be in that shoe. it's very embarrassing, to say the least, to admit that you've been concealing this deed from your father for years, and he's been mourning and mourning and grieving. About 20 years. And the father is now saying, you did what? But we'll discuss that with Judah shortly. So that's what we go through today, and these are symbols of the characters we're playing and reading about. Amos also reiterates a similar imagery. Okay, first of all, this chapter 37. I won't go through every single chapter in great detail, but we'll go through parts of it as we jump through these storylines, which we just read. Chapter 37, this is dominantly in my, of course, how I view this stuff. So these symbolisms are how I see it when I read this story. Jacob, verse 1. So Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings. It's important to note that we as people, we are sojourners, right? Are we settlers? No, we're not settlers. We're sojourners. We stay sojourners. What does that mean? You know that Abraham was a sojourner, Isaac was a sojourner, but Jacob's trying to settle, meaning to stay. He bought land there. He's building a home there. He tried to dwell in Shechem, said this would be a great place, tell his sons slaughter the Shechemites. And they said he had to run and they had to flee, but he is a settler. He wants to settle. I bring that up to you because it is important we realize that God does not want Jacob to settle. God is moving Jacob around. He moves him from Shechem. He then obviously moves him from Hebron into Egypt eventually too. He is not to settle. He is a traveler. We, the people of Israel, the God followers of God, we are travelers. We are not settlers. This earth does not belong to us, not belong to our land. It's not ours. We are travelers. Keep that in mind and remember that's important to remember that we are travelers. We're not settlers. So in Jacob's case, he's supposed to be traveling, but yet he's trying to settle in the land of his father's sojournings. We're giving this imagery of the first verse. You're comparing the trying to settle versus a sojourner, which obviously is never allowed to settle. Because they're trying to do it in where? The land of Canaan. Is that a good place? Or a bad place. It has lots of bad people in it. The land is probably fine. The people are gone. But the people themselves rule it. So the land is polluted as well. Do you want to settle in a bad place? Do you want to settle with evil people? Pretty much universally no. That's pretty consistent. So is this a good thing that he's wanting to settle there? No, it's not. And does God know it? Of course. What does God do? You're moving. You don't get to settle. Okay, so we start out there that Jacob doesn't belong in this spot, though he wants to be. So, since Joseph is representing the Messiah, we all have pretty much known that as Christian followers, as well as even many non-Christian are aware that Joseph is representing the Messiah in most of these stories. He is obviously very favored by Israel, which of course is Jacob, in verse 2. And he brings, of course, the bad report, which Alma had asked. What does that mean, a bad report? Messiah pointed out something while he was here on earth about 2,000 years ago. What was the report that he was pointing out of the Sadducees and Pharisees? Can you think of anything he said? Any phrase? Any comment? Anything that he said? Was it? Brood of vipers. That's an example. Is that a good report or a bad report? That'd be a bad report. On, not on Messiah, but on who he's reporting about. So, think of anything else he said.
Well, not scripturally.
Not scripturally. Yeah, any, what was that? Whitewashed tombs. You're on the surface clean, but inside you're empty and you're disgusting and falling apart. Hypocrites. Yes, these are hypocrites. Are any of those good reports?
Yeah.
No, they're bad reports. Who is Messiah reporting to, by the way? He talks to God all the time. So, if Joseph is sending bad reports about his brothers to Jacob, Messiah is sending bad reports about the people who were supposed to be in charge of God's flock, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, various other seeds you can think of, bad reports about them to the Heavenly Father. It's the same symbolism. It's the same scenario. It is Jacob's flock that these brothers are caring for. It is not their own. They're supposed to be following Jacob's interests and what is best interest of that flock and make them survive. Yes, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Like I said, I don't know how accurate this is, but I had done a study, quick study this week in the limited amount of time that I had, that there is a story out there that they were sacrificing the... they were consuming for themselves the flock that was supposed to be dedicated to God.
It could be. I have no knowledge of it. Whether that's an accurate report or not. I would have to say, since we're trying to make the comparison, or at least I'm discussing the comparison today, regarding the brothers and the who was in charge of the people at the time of Messiah in the similar type of comparison, because they're supposed to be God's flock, the God's people. How did the people in charge of God's flock or Messiah's time, how did they treat the people beneath them? Usury, almost. Yes.
Well, we know they misused at least one of Jacob's flock because they slaughtered a goat to pass Joseph
right.
off as dead.
That's
so we
right.
know they misused at least one.
At least one got suffered from it. At least one. There was a mistreatment at Messiah's time of the people, an incorrect or poor treatment of the people as far as how they were treated, what they had to do, what they made them do was incorrect and not proper in God's eyes. So you could... just a guess, that whatever the brothers were doing was not proper or in the flock's best interest, nor in Jacob's best interest. We don't know precisely what it was, but whatever it was not in the best interest of the flock or of Jacob. Anyway, let's continue on. So, as we said, bad reports, we can see how Messiah did similarly. Now, it says, of course, verse 3, Israel loved Joseph. You remember this phrase, you probably have heard this before a few times, "This is my son in whom I am well pleased." Ever heard that phrase before in the Bible? Yeah. Does God show favoritism to Messiah? Yes. Does Jacob show favoritism to Joseph? Yes. Is favoritism evil? Well, obviously not, because God's not evil. The point is, one child, one son, one individual is greater in God's use and purpose and esteem than the other one. God's right. Whatever we may think is wrong makes a difference. He chose favoritism because it meant something. It was important. He was actually just plain better. Messiah was better than all of us. We'll all admit that, right? And Joseph was better than his brothers, which is evident by the conspiracy to wipe him out. Clearly, they were not such good men. Obviously, the brothers, of course, saw this, were very upset. First of all, let's back a little bit. The thymol and tuluk, which I mentioned before, or the colorful tunic, Messiah obviously received great authority with him. As you recall, when he gets baptized, it says the Spirit came down and remained with him, with Messiah when he was baptized, which was different than everybody else's. It remains, it stayed there. Everybody else, it's like literally having like the clothing of God wrapped around you. It is remaining you. So it's the same type of symbol. The authority is given to him. So, of course, the brothers aren't too thrilled with that. In verse 4, it points out that they saw this issue. They saw that God, there, in this case, was Jacob, was with Joseph and not with them. So he hated him or didn't like him at all. Did leadership care or like Messiah at all? No. Did they conspire and want Messiah dead? Yes. So it's very similar feelings and emotions. Now, verse from 5 to 7, it talks about the sheaves in the field. I'm not going to interpret every little detail. It's the point. The point of the sheaves of the field is simply that you have sheaves in the field. Whether, I don't care what the sheaf is. It could be wheat, could be something else. I don't care. It doesn't make any difference. It's the what's happening around him. They all have to bow down or bowing down to Joseph's sheaf. Now, of course, he's going to see, obviously, his brothers bowing down, his 11 brothers' sheaves bowing down to him. Now, they interpret this event as themselves, and they're right. That's proven or demonstrated later on when they go before Joseph and they have to bow down in front of him. And he has all this great power and he has all the food. The sheaves. Whatever the sheaves were, whether they were wheat or barley or anything else, who cares? He has it all and they have to bow down to him. So and it points out, Joseph remembers this. He recalls his dreams when he sees them bowing down. What I want to bring your attention to is verse 8 to 10. Where the sun, the moon, the stars bow down to him. Does Jacob ever bow down to Joseph?
Yes.
No.
He didn't?
Jacob didn't bow down. He doesn't bow down to him. Does not bow down to him. Does Joseph's mother, who's dead, did she ever bow down to Joseph? No, she's dead. It's hard to bow down to your son when you're the dead body and he's the one still alive. But Jacob is the one who is interpreting the dream. Noted that? Now, Jacob is a dreamer as well. Jacob has his visions of Bethel. He has other dreams he's had, and he discusses a few of them with the sheep and the lambs and how they all got striped and speckled. He's a dreamer too. So he interprets and understands dreams, and he's noting that Joseph clearly is having dreams, and he's interpreting and sharing dreams. We have a correlation between what Jacob associates with Joseph. So one, they're attaching to each other. They're seeing this, but Jacob's interpreting the dream as the sun being himself, the moon his mother, and the 11 stars, of course, his other brothers. That actually makes sense. Although it never happens as long as Joseph lives. Joseph never sees that. His dead mother has not come from the grave and bowed down to him. We've read the story. Jacob also never bows down to Joseph. He does acknowledge Pharaoh, but not Joseph. Joseph is his junior, is his lower, is his beneath him. So this vision, this dream, doesn't happen in the lifetimes of the men who are having it. It's going to happen at some time later. Now, obviously, most of us have heard the story or are familiar with it. With the woman with the clothes, with the moon and the stars around her head and all that kind of stuff, all that stuff. And we spoke of the book of Revelations. We're familiar with that story. That is the only indication where you get the idea of who the woman actually was and who Israel is and who the sun is and who the stars are. Because that when that woman gives birth, the dragon is trying to kill the child, right? The child goes up into heaven. The woman, she has to flee and run. She is giving great authority or respect toward that child. But that's only an image. What's supposed to actually happen, everybody, when Messiah comes back down? Well, he reigns. What do the people have to do?
Get
to bow down your knee. Does it matter who you are?
No.
Every mother, every child, every father, you bow your knee. So will the sun and the moon bow to him? You better believe they're going to bow to him. Will Jacob bow before the Messiah? Of course he will. So will all of us. So we know it's going to happen. It doesn't happen in their lifetimes yet. It's a future dream. Just want to bring that out to you.
Okay.
Yes.
The woman.
Oh, sorry. Two people.
Okay, so who's the star and the moon that are under the woman?
In my opinion... This is my opinion speaking here. When you're dealing with star and sun and moons, you're dealing with times, you're dealing with seasons, you're dealing with people. So if you're dealing with, it says Messiah, he is the Lord of the Sabbath as well as everything else. It means he's the Lord of everything. Because all those items, those elements were designed to set times and seasons and appointments, which every one of us are supposed to be observing and following. So something greater than what we follow and do is guiding us, and that greater thing bows down to our Messiah. So what do? We bow down accordingly. Jacob is correct. He is interpreting the sun and the moon as he and the mom. He's the parents, meaning the authority, the patriarchs, the matriarchs. He is correctly interpreting those. I think he's right, at least. So if he's right interpreting them, and they're bowing down to their descendant, Messiah, what are we going to bow down to? The same Messiah, the same descendant, even though he is supposed to be lesser, meaning he's a descendant, not a parent of them. They are all bowing down to him as well. Yes?
I know this isn't the main context, but it occurred to me reading through this right now that the sun, moon, and stars do, they are what God set in motion to govern the seasons, the times, everything, and it just kind of made me think of how we expect Messiah to straighten all that out for us.
Straighten those things, details out, yes. And he's in charge of them, so they will obey him, whatever it may be. Let's continue on a little forward. Excuse me. Let's see here. Verse 14. I like this section because I think it's funny. Jacob is living where, of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Sarah, and Rebecca are all buried. He's living in that same area. He sends Joseph to his brothers, who, of course, hate him. I have a question for you. Does Jacob have any idea his brothers don't like him? Yes. Don't like his son? Yes. Did God have any idea that people on earth weren't going to like Messiah? Yes. So what does Jacob know? The same thing God knew. This wasn't going to go well with you, son. Whatever the story was. I have a question for you then. A follow-up question. If Jacob knew his brothers didn't like, or sorry, his sons didn't like Joseph, why did he send him? Trying to make him believe. Maybe that's the reason. Why did God send Messiah? Even though he knew the people weren't going to like him and were going to try to kill him, or in this case, actually to kill him. What did he do it for? To what? What was the reason? What was the reason he sent him? He had to save them, to correct them, to as Messiah pointed out, to return, to come back, to repent, to come back to Jacob, to come back to God. That was one of the major objectives of all the people, because all the flock had been wandering. They needed a better shepherd. Yes?
Jacob's a dreamer too, right?
Yes, they're both dreamers.
Is it possible that Jacob had a dream from Abba telling him to do that?
It is possible. It is possible. We do not know how much he... We don't know. We don't know. If Jacob had a dream given by God, it's not recorded. I can't. Yeah. You can't. It's just a guess. It's just a guess. But they are dreamers. They are dreamers. They're not like a daydreamers, but actually understanding dreams. Yes.
Well, God, the only one God could trust to be his emissary was a Messiah.
Was one.
Benjamin is either... Benjamin's way too young at this point.
Right.
So who else could Jacob trust to be his, quote, emissary to the brothers?
Joseph. Joseph's it. Joseph is the trusted person. And Joseph brought forth not false reports, but what's called evil or bad reports. I mean, he told Jacob what was actually happening. He's telling him the truth. Were any of the other sons volunteering, oh, Dad, guess what bad things I did today? How many of us did that as kids? Okay, some did. Most of us don't do that. Say, hey.
Not until the 21st.
When you did something bad, you say, guess what, Mom, Dad, look how bad things I did today. And go, you don't usually report bad things you do in a day. Typically, that's that you reserve or try to brush under the rug. You hide them. So Joseph is willing to report the truth, what's actually happening, which Messiah was willing to report, the truth, what's actually happening. It's important we note what these guys are doing. excuse me. So God had to send Messiah to do a particular job, to essentially take over control of the flock. That was Messiah's job. And Joseph, by sending bad reports, he actually goes back reporting back to his father. If all went according to what Jacob's envisioned was, what do you think he was going to put Joseph in charge of? His whole sheep, his whole, everything he had. That would have been Jacob's probable intent. Remember the big coat he put on him, the great nice things? He was obviously lifting him up greater than his brothers. It was in Jacob's intent, most likely, to put Joseph in charge of all of his brothers. That was most likely the intent, which corresponds to the dreams Joseph had, corresponds to what we know about Messiah. That was the intent. That was the goal, the objective. When he's dead, what happened in Jacob's heart and mind? All my hopes and dreams just vanished. I can't use him as the one in charge. Now, of course, we already know how the story ends. So we have the comparison of how these men are doing. So God knew Messiah was going to be killed, and Jacob knew his brother, his other sons, were not going to treat Joseph very well. Maybe not knowing he's going to die, but at least knew he wasn't going to be treated very well. That he was greatly hated. Excuse me. So this, of course, symbolically tells us that Jacob, or God, sent Joseph/Messiah to his brothers into an area, which I want to point this out to you, which I like this, the way it's phrased. Jacob thought and believed his sons were in Shechem. God intended the leadership of his flock to go one place, one way, live one way of life. Did the leadership of God's flock live that one way of life? In the history of Israel, going all the way through Messiah's life, from beginning Adam all the way through, did the people in charge of God's flock, all of God's people, were they directing or leading God's flock in a place where God wanted them to go? You sure? Because where'd they end up? If they lead them there on purpose, God wanted the people to be abused and taken over and trashed by the time Messiah shows up, then that would make a lot of sense. So, God... Go ahead. Oh, right. We were discussing what's going to happen. We're discussing the comparisons. Actually, I'll draw it out. It makes life simpler, right? My eraser. I lost it. Oh, here it is. The right-hand side. I'm going to erase a small section of this because it's not terribly important. Nobody ever told you. Oh, is that a permanent direct marker? Yeah, it's alcohol. Bring them up. So, if God knew and he had people in charge of his flock, so we have God's flock, right? And his intent is that this flock grow, be prosperous, and continue on into everlasting life. I'm abbreviating. Now, did God's flock stay there? Did they go there? You know the story of Israel. What happened? They always mess up. They always went up and down and sideways in any way direction where God didn't want them to go. God had people in charge of his flock. Who were they? There were the priesthood, of course, it followed by the kings, which followed by, I guess, Hasmonean period. And then, of course, it goes into the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and, of course, after that, the rabbinical, all the leadership, those people who were in charge. Are any of them directing God's flock, the people, to everlasting life? No, that's not their objective. That wasn't their point. So the flock was not being led to where it was supposed to be. It was not where God's intent was, the place we wanted to be. In Jacob's time, with his flock, he believes and is under the impression or the understanding that his flock is at or went to a particular place called Shechem. That's where he believes the flock is. That's where he was told what he was told and instructed to his sons to send them to. That's where he wanted them to be. Are his sons in Shechem?
No.
Did God's leadership lead God's flock where God wanted them to be? No. Jacob's son did not lead Jacob's flock where he wanted them to be. Both of them did the same error, mistake. Messiah shows up in Jacob's time, known as Joseph, and shows, oh, no, they led them to a different place called Dothan. Where Joseph is symbolically killed in a pit. I use it symbolically because he wasn't actually killed. God's flock didn't go where God intended to be, the leadership didn't send us. He sent his son, known as Messiah, to earth. Where, instead of Messiah seeing where God's flock was supposed to be, which is to everlasting life, he saw they weren't there, they ended up, and what happened to him?
He got killed.
He got physically killed in the pit of the grave. See any kind of parallel? Okay, so that's the point. We're dealing with imagery and how this cycle is going through. Which part am I missing?
Joseph comes out alive, and so did
right.
Messiah.
I'm not there yet. You have to wait. I'll discuss Joseph and how he comes back out and how Messiah comes out in a minute. I have to get there first. That's not fair. Let's continue on going. Let's see here. Okay. So we see how Jacob and how God are being related and how they're working with the story. Now, it was intent by Reuben to save Joseph's life. I lost my eraser again. There it is. I'm going to erase this again because, well, I already explained it.
Did he put it off because he was afraid of what's going to happen to him?
Ask your question again. Did he what?
Did Reuben put off pulling him out because he was afraid his brothers would come against him?
Well, it was intended for Reuben to find him later, meaning when his brothers weren't around or not obviously there. It's important to remember that because it wasn't within Reuben's authority. This is a huge thing, everybody. It wasn't, even he's the oldest, it was not within his authority to overrule them all and go take him in their presence. I want to bring that to you really importantly because Reuben in this story is playing a particular character known as a prophet. He is playing the prophet's character. When the prophets came to the leadership of Israel with the kings, we read these guys, what were they trying to tell the kings and the people of Israel? Trying to tell them to do what is right. Don't do what is wrong. You're doing what is wrong. Fix it. Do what is right. Did the prophets have the ability to go in and enforce what is right? No, they didn't. The kings did. Yes, go ahead.
Except for the ones that wielded swords and chopped opposing kings' heads off.
That's true. If you do that. But in general, they don't. One. Yeah. Yeah, those only two. And Samson actually, he does some work by leveling some places. But even then, it is the responsibility belongs on those who are in charge. So a prophet's job is not to enforce, per se, although there were exceptions, to enforce God's command. It is the people's job to enforce it. Obviously, Moses enforced a whole lot of power, but yet Pharaoh is the one who had to relent and say, let him go. It wasn't Moses saying, okay, Pharaoh, you disagree, I'm overruling you, we're going anyway. He didn't do that. Because Moses couldn't overrule Pharaoh. Pharaoh is the king. Well, Reuben doesn't get to overrule all of his brothers. His brothers are in charge, and in particular, Judah. So the prophets are Reuben's playing the prophets very well. And does Judah, to the people, do they hear the prophets' counsel?
No.
Sort of. Not really. They did a half-hearted. And that, well, they didn't kill him then. They threw him in a pit. They didn't kill him. So they did that part. But then they did not disclose, apparently, to Reuben what happened to the boy later on. That's a guess, though, because we don't know how much they explained. So Israel does not hear the prophets of God, and Judah did not hear Reuben's counsel to save the boy. Judah got money out of it instead, which Amos rails against shortly, which we'll get there. Let's continue on. Get a time. Okay. Let's jump to payback. This is Genesis chapter 38. I'm going to erase some of this because it's not relevant right now. Let's see here. So we have up here, I have a harlot and I have Judah playing Israel. And my marking over earlier. And I have over here the righteous / poor Tamar. I like this section. Okay, so those are the three characters. The Tamar and Harlot's a mix. It's two characters, but in parts it's three. So in chapter 38, we'll go through this relatively quickly because it's really more of a payback. The first payback, Judah gets two. He gets payback twice for his treatment of Joseph. And it's important to remember that because Amos says, again, the same thing, which I like about Amos in chapter 2. So Judah gets paid back. Judah separates himself from his brothers. What the reason is, I couldn't tell you. But either way, he's still the dominant character. As you know today, and because you've read the book of Israel, the Bible, we know what the story happens with the kings and the Judah and the Israel and how they all happen. Judah is a dominant tribe of the southern, eventually the dominant tribe of all of Israel. Even modern day today, Israel is still dominated by Judah versus anybody else. So Judah is the dominant tribe in these regions. So he has to separate himself for whatever reason he chooses to do so. That's his business. At this story in chapter 38, Judah is taking a shift of roles, but he's still playing overall the people of Israel. So his daughter-in-law is who changes things. So when Judah sold his brother into death/slavery, that's no different than how Messiah was sold into death. In this case, it wasn't slavery, but just plain death. But it's the same type of principle. In this chapter, Judah is humiliated in a couple of different ways. Obviously, he has, you know, sons. He has three sons that he names the first one. His wife names the second, and I'm not sure who names the third one. But they all go through a process. They're evil. They have their goods and bads, and mostly the bad. So they do bad things. In verse, so after his first son dies, then Judah says, "Onan, consort with your brother." Of course, he spills the seed on the ground. Why is that evil?
Have to
right. You have to have offspring to your brother. What's why would Onan not want that?
Because
it wouldn't be his. Right, wouldn't be his. What does that care? Why would Onan care if it wasn't his child?
Because that child then would inherit the rights of the firstborn in the name of the older son.
Bingo. All because if you recall the Torah, now I know it's not officially written, but these men are still living mostly by it. The firstborn son gets what portion of the dad's stuff? A double from everybody else. So, with Er dead, instead of the inheritance of Judah divided between three boys, but one boy gets double, so it's four equal portions, but one guy gets two of them. And now it's divvied up into three equal portions, and Onan gets two. He gets two-thirds of dad's stuff. Unless... Yeah, with his own wife. Unless... Er, his older brother, has a child. And then, essentially, most of Onan's possessions vanish in front of his eyes and go to Er's descendants, and he doesn't get anything. Well, not anything. He gets very little. So, it is very evil. It is a purely selfish desire for gain, personal gain. So, yeah, it is an evil act. Now, I'm not saying, you know, we should all, you know, obey how the with regard to, you know, death of siblings. I'm just saying that what he was doing was it. That's what they did then. I'm not going to argue right or wrong. It's just what they did. And his motives behind it are very selfish. So, of course, Judah loses two sons and his wife in this chapter. I do not know how old Judah is, nor do I know how old his wife is, but obviously she died relatively young compared to some of the other people in this in the Bible. Then I guess I don't know how long the women lived then. He picks up Tamar, his daughter-in-law, and says, of course, remain till Shelah is old. And she's older. And of course, Shelah grows up, doesn't want to do that because he's afraid of Shelah's death as well. What does she do? We know what she does. Is it right or wrong? That's a tough question. Judah claims what she did was more right than what he did. Think about that for a minute. Her actions, good or bad, were better than his own. What kind of person would think that? I mean, she deceived him, it was harlotry, she tricked him, and all this various stuff that she had to do to go through this whole process, and somehow that's better than him saying, you know, I don't want you marrying my youngest son? Yeah. He did. He did deceive her in her father's home. He deceived her too. My point I want to bring to your attention is Judah is playing the role of the people of Israel in this story. Oh, yes. Go ahead, Carrie.
I would say a goal-oriented person.
Goal-oriented.
Well, yeah, because realistically, I mean, generally, we really don't have this option, or at least we don't know how to play it out, but she forced him into righteousness as he knew it.
Right. She did. In this story, she is classified as the righteous Tamar, and Judah is not. He is still playing the role of Israel. In the book of Amos, where did my other Bible go? Oh, here it is. Jump to Amos chapter 2 real quick. I can find that small book. It's a very small one. There it is. That's cheating. Computer? Oh, that's just wrong. Let's see here. Anyway, let's go through verse jumps in verse 6 of chapter 2 of the book of Amos. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not away his punishment. They sell the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of sandals. What did Judas sell Joseph for? Silver. They pant after the dust of the earth, which is on the head of the poor, and pervert the way of the humble. A man and his father go into the same girl. What did Judah do? Went into the same girl, known as Tamar, okay, as his sons have done. In order to defile my holy name, they lie down by every altar, and the clothes taken in pledges. What happened to Judah's clothes taken in pledge? Uh-huh, they lied on that too. They drink the wine of condemnation, the house of their God. Is Judah in God's house this time? No, he left his family's house. Remember, he's departed his family's house to go his own ways to the Adullamite. And of course, he's marrying Canaanites and such too. Yet, of course, it was I, verse 9, God, who destroyed the Amorite from before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and he was as strong as the oaks. I destroyed his fruit above and his roots beneath. It was I who brought you up from the land of Egypt and led you 40 years to the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. I raised up some of your sons as prophets and some of your young men as Nazarites. Is it not so, children of Israel, says the Lord? But you gave the Nazarites wine to drink and commanded the prophets, saying, do not prophesy. So I want to point out, do not prophesy. Was Judah thrilled with Reuben's plan? Reuben's playing a prophet. No, he wasn't. He decided to sell. Judah was not intending to return Joseph back to his dad, the righteous Joseph. He was intending in this case, he was going to kill him, but he decided to go ahead and sell him instead. He wasn't listening to prophets much like, again, prophets don't prophesy. I'm not going to listen to you. So in this story, in Tamar, in the story of Judah, we are reading, of course, also in Amos similarly, that these are evil acts. All of them are. In Amos' story, when it says two men go to the same woman, is he railing against the woman? Who is he railing against? The man, Israel. So in the story of Tamar and Judah, who is God upset with? The woman, Tamar, or with Judah? Judah. He's upset with Judah. And of course, uses Judah's sons. So there's obvious parallels between Amos and how Judah lived his life with Tamar, at least early on. I won't go through the whole story of Tamar, other things to cover today. But of course, she goes through, she comes out, she takes her three items, the signet ring, the pledge, the cloth, robe, whatever it looked like, I don't know, and of course, the staff identifies. What I like about this and why I say it's payback time in this chapter is her words in verse 25. She says, identify if you please. Who are the signet ring, this wrap, and the staff? What were the words given to Jacob when they brought the coat to him with the blood? It says, identify if you please. Wow. It's like a slap in the face. Essentially what it is, a slap in the face. And Judah hears the same words that were said to his dad. Your sin is now well exposed, Judah. And it's important to remember the sin is well exposed. It's now a very public issue. It's not a private thing. It's now everybody knows. Very well known. They're very well established. So, of course, he recognizes that she's right. I was wrong. She, of course, gives birth to two sons. I won't go into details of Sarah and Perez, pronounce it correctly. What happens to the two of them and how they all deal with their issues. But the point is, the firstborn, Zerah, gets, essentially, bupkis compared to what Perez gets. Perez, the secondborn, comes out first per se, but he wasn't the firstborn. He gets the entire royal line of David and all the Messiah's royal line. What's Zerah get? Kick in the pants. Go away. That's what happens to their descendants. They are literally thrown by the wayside as if nobody cares about them anymore. Yet he's the firstborn of this event. It's important to remember that too, because we have a comparison of two different types of sons, two different types of people. One by promise, one by flesh. The firstborn, flesh, Zerah, didn't get the promise. The second one, not born by flesh, got the promise, which was the royal line of David. Yes.
Did Zerah have the red string tied on his head?
Yes, Zerah had a red string on his head. The symbol today is still the red hand, actually.
Yeah,
you see that? You probably have seen that. In Irish and Welsh, they use the red hand as their symbol. That's what it is. It's Zerah's symbol. I won't say anything beyond that. That's just what the symbols means. You have probably also seen the hand that's still done in I forgot what it's called. There's the peace hand, whatever it is, used on some mezuzahs in Judaism. Was it? Hamsun, thank you. It's same principle. It's the hand. There's other pagan stuff to it too. That's not the point. The point is the symbol's still there. Let's continue on. So go past Judah and Tamar. Let's move on to back to Joseph, because we have some dreams and some prison time. Joseph, of course, goes to Potiphar. He's, happy and content. Nice living the good life, per se. He's elevated, of course, to God's right hand. mean, the Messiah is elevated to God's right hand. Joseph, of course, is elevated to Potiphar's right hand and the prison guard's right hand and Pharaoh's right hand. See a theme? Elevated up to the right hand three times. That's, you know, sign of Messiah, from going from destitute poverty slash slavery and condemnation of death, brought back up from each of those things into the right hand. Now, the pit he got brought up from that had no water in it, I mean no life in it, was brought up from his brothers before he was sold into slavery. He, of course, was raised up to Potiphar's right hand. And, of course, the next one, which Potiphar is brought down, he's brought down at the prison. And, of course, where the prison guard brings his right hand as being, he's very trustworthy. Is Messiah trustworthy?
Yes.
In spite of his circumstances of what surrounds him? Yes. In spite of who is around him? Yes. Go ahead.
So what you're saying, it's better to be at God's right hand than at his backhand.
Yes.
Let's see here. That was over that one. That one threw me a little bit.
Okay, so let's jump back to the other harlot. So now we know how Judah dealt with the harlot of Tamar. Now we'll deal with how Joseph deals with his harlot, not obviously his personal one, but the harlot that is both the evil Egyptian woman. I'm not saying that evil Egyptian women are all evil, just in this particular one. Potiphar's wife. I don't know her name. I don't really care. So her intent, of course, is to corrupt Joseph. Joseph treats this harlot as she is, a harlot. Judah, of course, treated his harlot, Tamar, very different, how they happen to work. But this harlot is not the righteous harlot that Tamar played. She's playing the harlot that is purely evil. The goal of corruption, of self-pleasure. That's what she's after. If he chose to be with her, do you think the whole household of Potiphar would have found out?
Yes.
They gossip, they go all the place. They know for what's going on. Would it be hidden for long? No. Does God know about it? Yes. So would bad things happen? Yes. So all these bad things would have happened to Joseph, of course, had he laid with Potiphar's wife. She, of course, tempted him multiple times, and of course, and finally lies in order to get into prison. Was Messiah lied about to get him into prison? Actually, in this case, to death. Yes, he was. How did Messiah treat it? When people brought lies about him and accusations to him, what was his responses? He did use stories and parables, but when he's brought up in front of, in this case, it was a Sanhedrin at the time, what did he say? Very, very little. Virtually nothing. Because what he was doing, Messiah was doing, obviously he knew what the God's intent was, what the end outcome was going to be, why bother fight it. But what he's doing in that demonstration is that, wait a minute, everybody around me knows full well who I am and what I am. What I've done, my reputation precedes me by leaps and bounds. That reputation should be strong. And it is strong. And he was strong. What did Joseph say? He got thrown in prison. What did he say? Is that what he said? It said nothing. The right. That's later. Years later, he talks with him. I don't belong here in this prison pit. But as far as when he's brought the accusation, there's no record of him saying, I didn't do it. She's lying. What do you think would have happened if he had told Potiphar that his wife is a liar? Probably wouldn't go over well. What do you think would have happened to him? Well, when you accuse Pharaoh's top officials of being married to liars, are they happy with you?
No.
Do bad things usually end for you? Yes. So, keep mouth shut, because the outcome's the same either way. At least this way, you'll live. It's not going to make a difference. You're not going to change the outcome. It's not giving up to the inevitable. It's just the fact that you can't change the outcome. So, do what is the wisest choice. He kept his mouth shut. Very smart man. Of course, he's there. He's put in charge of everything. Hey, I'm doing really well on time. That's great. Let's move forward a little bit. So let's see here. I personally look at this way in this particular way. You don't have to look at the same way. I look at Potiphar's wife as no more than a pagan or corruption of anybody. A corruption of someone, a corruption of the world in general. Messiah, when he died in this world of corruption, right? He was in order to save it. In Joseph's time, when he's being thrown into the dungeon pit, he's being thrown in there. He didn't do anything wrong. He didn't do anything wrong at all. But God's ultimate objective, of course, is to make Joseph in charge of everything. And this is the way he's going to do it. Well, God's objective with Messiah was to make him in charge of everything too. And the way he chose Messiah to do it was to kill him. So the way God chose Joseph to do it was to throw him in a pit. In this case, the pit of the prison. Which, frequently, those who are not familiar with prisons back then, did people live long? Is it a retirement plan? No, it's a retirement plan. You don't, unless it's really short retirement. Yeah, you retire. You're done. It's not a long-term health, you know, benefit. It's bad for you. So you're going to likely die in prison anyway. Whether they kill you immediately or wait a few years, you're probably still dead. Those you've probably heard, I think it's called St. Peter's Prison in Russia. Not many make it out of that one in Russia. Or for like about a month's time, you've probably lost at least 50 to 100 pounds. And then 2 months later, you're now dead. That's just prison. Enjoy it, right? I do not know the Egyptian prison was much better. It's probably not as cold as Russia's prison. But still, it's still probably not very pleasant either. He, of course, goes down. He doesn't deserve to be there. Potiphar's wife plays this harlot, and, of course, it brought him into this position. Messiah's life was given up in order to save all of us in the room, right? How corrupt was Potiphar's wife? Very. How corrupt are we? Very corrupt. We don't even know that. We have a lot of corruption within inside of us. That's how it's built into it. His goal was to save us. God's goal is to save us. How much corruption is inside of Joseph's brothers? Very corrupt. All this goal, all this process is in order to save them. So that's what he's doing. So let's go through here. Of course, obviously, he gets falsely accused of things, just like Tamar is falsely accused, but she is accused in this whole prison cycle. I'm going to draw this real quick, if I can draw it very fairly well. I hope so. Let's see here. I'm going to deal with these dreams rather briefly. I shouldn't have used that marker. It's kind of makes funky marks on this board. I'm going to wipe it off a little better. That could be an old marker. That didn't help much, did it? Make it worse. Okay. Well, just bear with me with the color funny marks. Let's see here. So, Joseph is accused by, of course, Potiphar's wife. He, of course, is obviously sent into prison, which did the prison guard hold him? He kept him, but did he hold him as a prisoner? No, he didn't. So he went to prison, but the prison couldn't hold him. Can death hold Messiah? No, it didn't. Would prison hold any one of us? Yes, it would. Would we likely die in prison, in these types of prisons? Most likely. I'm not that strong. Maybe some of you are, but I'm not. I wouldn't live long. But prison couldn't hold Joseph, and death couldn't hold Messiah. So then, he's now, death is not able, sorry, the prison's not able to hold him. He's still there. He's still officially died. But he's not able to hold him. He's in charge of it now. That prison then has two people come. In this case, the wine cup bearer and the baker, right? They have dreams. So they have dreams. And what's the interpretation of the dreams? In 3 days, they both get lifted up. 3 days, one's lifted up back into his position. And the other one's lifted up and his head's removed. Meaning in the form of a hanging. Now, we should see that in this place that cannot hold Joseph, meaning the prison, he's not in his prison cell, it cannot hold him, can't hold Messiah either, death can't hold Messiah. In 3 days, one's lifted up and the other one stays dead, or becomes dead in this case. So we have obviously the sign of Messiah with regard to 3 days, lifted up, meaning life versus death. And of course, it's done across on Pharaoh's birthday, right or wrong, we won't discuss that. Let's continue on. So after 3 days, the baker's dead, the cupbearer's brought back. Is he born 20 years? No, born on the third day. So, after the third day, he's brought back. And what happens to cupbearer? Got over here. His job back, and does he remember Messiah or Joseph? There's Messiah / Joseph. Spell Joseph correctly, that is an E. Job back, he gets job back. Joseph is forgotten about for how long?
I don't know.
2 years. 2 years. Now, if that's recorded, the first verse of the following section. For 2 years, he is forgotten about. My personal, Daniel H.'s opinion, that is about a 2,000-year period to me. I could be wrong. My personal opinion, so it's mine. He's forgotten about, meaning he is not considered important for that period of time. That whole stretch for 2 years, he's left forgotten about it. Until, of course, Pharaoh has his dreams and Joseph's needs are brought up to be called upon. So in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, that is where that the symbolism goes through the cycle of that time period. It's a symbolism, of course, the sign of Messiah living through his life. We're going to jump. Any questions so far regarding that? Okay. And it's just my personal, how I see it. I'm going to go. Oh, go ahead.
I don't know. I was just thinking, have you noticed a similarity between the two people, one lived and one died, and the goats?
Goats. Oh, as far as the during atonement?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't actually thought about that before. It's an interesting idea.
I hadn't really either, because it happens, and then kind of the next main event is Joseph
obviously
comes out.
Right. That's true. That's an interesting concept. I hadn't thought about that. It could make sense, and that because at atonement, you have the two goats, right? You have the goat where everybody puts their hands on, says all the bad things, forgive us, blah, blah, and then the goat that dies. The one goat that's killed the time at that moment in time, one is left to go off in the wilderness. Well, it's atoning of all of Israel. That's an interesting idea. I do not know if that symbolism. See, could it apply? It's conceivable. I don't have to think about that one. I don't know. Because it is interesting because both cupbearer and the baker are sent to the prison because Pharaoh thinks they've done something wrong. Obviously, it wouldn't be there. And one is proven right or forgiven, and one is proven as the punishment. Yes, Tammy.
I also find a couple of things interesting. One is that you have the wine bearer and the baker. This isn't the treasurer and the scribe.
No.
So those elements are there.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that most likely if Potiphar was in charge of, if he's the more like the chief chef or the chief cook, in charge of Pharaoh's household, the way Joseph was maybe in charge of his household, then you also have the issue of most likely one of the reasons that the wine bearer and the cup bearer may have been in jail in the first place is probably because probably Potiphar is the one that threw them in jail too, just like he's the one that threw Joseph in jail.
It very well could have. That would make sense. If he's
food for thought.
Food for thought. That's pretty good. He's at two today. That's not bad. It's on a roll. We're going to, let's see here. I don't know if I jump there today or not. I might. I might go there. Well, I guess it doesn't hurt. So let's continue on. I'm going to jump a little bit out of any question of the Torah study section, because this is pretty much the extent in which I'm going to explain the Torah portion. I'm going to jump out of there now. I already read you a good portion, though not all, of the book of Amos regarding how it relates to Judah. But there's more to it than just that. I had stopped on purpose in verse 12. I'm going to continue on and go back to the book of Amos, chapter 2, and jump to verse 13. This is again tied into how Judah and how Messiah and the relationship works for and against each other. So Amos 2, verse 13. Behold, I am weighted down by you, as a cart is weighted down, is full of sheaves. That's where God is speaking, of course. Therefore, flight shall perish from the swift. The strong shall not strengthen his power, nor shall the mighty deliver himself. He shall not stand who handles the bow. The swift of foot shall not deliver himself, nor shall he who rides a horse deliver himself. The most courageous of mighty shall flee naked in that day, says the Lord. Verse chapter 3. Hear this, Lord has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. Can two walk together unless they are agreed? Will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Will a young lion cry out in his den if he has caught nothing? Will the bird fall in a snare on the earth where there is no trap for it? Will a snare spring up from the earth if it has caught nothing at all? If a trumpet is blown in the city, will not the people be afraid? If there is calamity in a city, will not the Lord have done it? Surely the Lord does nothing unless he reveals his secrets to his servants or prophets. A lion has roared, who will not fear? The Lord has spoken, who can but prophesy? In this scenario, which we've read with regard to how Judah dealt with Tamar and how Judah dealt with Joseph and how God brought Joseph up where he needed to be out of this depths of misery, Judah got publicly humiliated in the process, actually in both times. I'm bringing that out to us, it's on purpose. Why I want to bring that up to you many times, a couple times already, and I'm going to continue on with it for a few more minutes, is that when Messiah returns back to our earth and just and everybody says, hey, that's who he is, who's going to be publicly humiliated? Judah. Who do you think, who is responsible? Well, not only not believe in Messiah, they have fought against him in the past. They have, obviously, they took the responsibility for his death upon themselves way back when Messiah died. They're the ones who've been advocating for literally generations, for actually millennia now, instead of a couple thousand years, that he was a fraud, that he's a bad guy. He wasn't what he said he was. He deceived everybody. And is any of it true? No. So, who was publicly humiliated, or likely to be, just as Judah is publicly humiliated with his actions, to when he had to go to, when he has to go back to Jacob, obviously when Joseph is revealed? That public humiliation is a big thing. It's not something he likes. But I wanted to bring that up to you because in Amos, who we had just read in verse 15, it said, he shall not stand who handles the bow, since his foot shall not deliver himself, he who rides a horse cannot deliver himself. That there is no way out of this. There is the humiliation that's going to be occurring. This correction, which is, of course, Amos, the first part of it, or first, well, from verse 6 on, discusses already Judah, Israel. You've made some serious errors. There is only one solution. It's going to be a very humiliating place to be, as was for Judah the man. I didn't start with it, but I kind of started with it early on. Jump to Revelations real quick, chapter 12. Because I mentioned before, everybody has to bow down to one individual. I'm not going to read the whole section, because we're at just part of it. Chapter 12, it says, now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed the sun with the moon under her feet, and her head on the garland of 12 stars. Then, being with child, she cried out in labor, the pain to give birth. And another sight appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diamonds on his head. Tail drew a third of the stars to heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled the wilderness where she is a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. In the imagery that we're given in Joseph's, we already talked about, Joseph's dream regarding the sun, the moon, the stars, and how this was bowed down to him, this is the next place which the Bible talks about the same type of imagery. And who gets brought up to heaven? Well, the child does. Who gets brought up by Joseph? Of course, obviously, or at Joseph's time, Joseph is brought up. A place is prepared. Joseph, which we haven't talked to, Jeff will get to it, he tells his brothers, you didn't do this to me. God did. To prepare a place for you. But that was the goal. It may be publicly humiliating to Judah when Messiah comes back and explains and says who he is. They didn't do it. God did. God is the one in control. He planned it out. This was his intent. as he explains it to us here in the book of Genesis, Messiah isn't even born yet, and we're reading about it in Joseph's life. God clearly planned this out a long time before any of it was going to play out in our own histories and regarding Messiah's life. So God's the one in charge. He's the one deciding this. And it's not by your strength, not by Judah's strength, not by anybody's strength, that they make their way through. Because the place, as verse 6 says, a place was prepared for you, for the woman. Now, who is the woman in this story in the book of Revelations? Well, she gives birth to the Messiah. She's in charge of Messiah. She has the stars over her head, and she's clothed with the sun and the moon. The only people that that corresponds to is Israel as a whole. As a whole, meaning not just the tribe of Judah, but all the tribes. Corresponds to all of them. They're all as one group, one unit. So they're all of their existence and being, they have a place prepared for them by God, and their goal was to produce a single child. One. Messiah. That was the goal. And that's how God chose to do it. It's preset. And they don't get to go up to God. The woman doesn't get to go up to God. They have to go to a prepared place in the wilderness, away from God, away from the people. And where is this prepared place for Judah's brothers? Or sorry, for Joseph's brothers? It's in Joseph's time, the prepared place is not in Israel. It is in Egypt. Yeah, in the Goshen territory. A place that was not theirs, not given to them originally, but it's a place prepared for them to preserve them, to spare them, to let them to live. So all of this, again, is Judah is the one who's, I guess lack of a better term, he's the picture on the front of the story as far as responsibility. But realistically, God is the one doing every single thing, every element, every part. He's making sure it all happens the way he wants it to happen. He's in charge. It doesn't matter whether it's written way back here at the time of Genesis or whether it's written, in even our modern day, headlines. It doesn't make a difference. God's the one doing it all. He's planning this out. So this plan, this cycle is inside this intent. The last place I'm going to head today, get here, and I'll let you go. It's, where is it? In the book of Acts, you don't have to go there. And Stephen's, of course, relaying his story. The patriarchs, were envious of Joseph. He sold him into slavery. Of course, God was with him, delivered him out of his trouble. So this child that this people present, that Israel produces, this one child, that envious approach, that envy, the desire to be him instead of him being over us, that's still a human part of us, isn't it? It's a part of me. I'm sure it's probably part of you too. He's the older brother by right. He's better. And we have to accept that and know that. Judah isn't to be envious, we are not to be envious, and most importantly, Joseph winds up telling his brothers, don't fight among yourselves, pointing out that you did this or you did that, it's all your fault. The emotion that comes along when you realize you've been publicly humiliated is a hard one to cope with. It really is. How we deal with it is an important part of us. Important part of who we're supposed to be. Torah observant people, right? That means you have to watch your own emotions, your own ideas and your own thoughts, and your own accusations. I do. We all do. So this is going to be happening in our future, hopefully, someday. Don't know when, but at some point it will happen. And our own state, our own way of being has to be better than Judah's at the time of Tamar, the time of later on when he deals with Joseph. Any questions or comments regarding the Torah section or any of the half-Torah parts in the New Testament I read? Yes, Alma.
I just find it interesting that Judah said, burn the harlot.
Yes.
And the written Torah was not there yet.
Right.
They haven't received it from Sinai.
Right, they had not received it yet.
And the other one is, how did they know that they had to, that Judah had to give them the kids? Because, like I said, the Torah was not. So God did talk to them.
He did talk to them.
They received the instructions.
Information, instructions.
Way.
Well in advance. Yes, and that's what a lot of, excuse me, a lot of people have asked and asked a question, and I can't say right or wrong necessarily, whether or not the patriarchs held kept the high days, the holy days, or any of the other details in the Torah. Yes, they obviously kept many of them, many of the laws, but we don't know what they knew, what they didn't know. My personal opinion is that they probably did not know the high days the way that we know them. For example, we understand Passover in a particular way, known as coming out of Egypt, the great, you know, the Passover lamb, of course, death of Messiah. That's how we understand Passover. Well, those events that define Passover didn't happen yet from the patriarchs. So they would not have recognized the same identity, the same way why you're doing certain things. However, clearly, they knew how to act, how to live. How'd they get that information? Good question. Now, Cain and Abel, he knew how to sacrifice animals. Of course, he's raising animals, which implies he was eating animals because he wasn't raising crops. You can't eat anything then. He raises animals. How do you know what they were? Why was he doing that? What's the point? It doesn't say why. Clearly, he knew they meant something. And I'm inclined to believe the angels of God were more like instructors at the time when Adam and Eve were being created in their life and how you live your life. I'm more inclined to believe that they were more interactive to people in how they're supposed to live. So how much information got to them, I don't know. Obviously enough to them to accomplish this. Many of the Torah laws are written, I should say because of, but are used as examples in the patriarchs' lives, how they screwed up. With the whole don't marry two sisters, don't marry your next of kin, whether the sister of your, or sorry, the daughter of your father or your mother. The patriarchs, what they intermarried all the time. So a lot of those rules were written after they lived their lives. Now, were they written because their lives or not? I don't know. But they lived their life, and then the laws were written later. They weren't living by those laws, obviously, because clearly they married, you know, ways that was designed to be married. But they were doing certain things. So they knew how to deal with harlots, they knew how to deal with various things in this nature, as well as, you know, even cleanliness. Moses was also fairly wise, and I think the Egyptians were not foolish either on how you live lives too. So I'm inclined to believe that God was communicating with people not just through our Bibles. I don't think he only used our Bibles to communicate with somebody. He used visions and dreams. And there are even references in the Bible to other texts and other events that aren't even recorded in it. So God still is involved in other cultures, other people's lives, and somehow he gets information to them. Yes, Carrie?
I would think a lot of this stuff is passed down generationally as well.
Because, I would think so too.
Because even for Abel to sacrifice an animal, I mean, at some point, his parents probably told their children about how they tried to do it with plants and God did it with leather. You know, so, yeah. And also, you know, we've looked at even the account of Adam and Eve and how it's very likely that it was an appointment that they had missed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so their children at some point would have learned that there are appointments. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of that stuff would probably be passed down, kind of the Jewish tradition of the verbal.
It's the oral law, so to speak, right? It's a way of life. I had to just discuss that or deal with that earlier this week regarding how much information they would have known or not known back then, because their world would have looked very, very different than ours. Obviously, it's pre-flood, but I don't know if you've ever noticed or paid any attention that before, you know, early on, before, like as in thousands of years ago, somehow they knew what the planets looked like. Have you noticed that? They knew that Mars was red. They knew that Saturn had rings around it. They knew what these planets looked like. They knew that Neptune and all these other things existed. And how's that possible? Because I can't see them with my naked eye. I can't even see with binoculars. You know what? Even a cheap telescope, I can't see them. How'd they do that? So there's things they say, okay, they knew things that are not recorded in our Bibles. So obviously they were dealing with stuff and God was talking to them, or somehow They got information that wasn't already recorded there. So their way of life was that way. They knew things, Alma. They knew how life was lived and how it should be lived. I don't know how they all knew, but they knew. Any questions or comments? Yes, Tammy.
I was just thinking back to this a little bit, back to the whole thing with Judah and Tamar.
Mm-hmm.
When Tamar basically outs Judah,
yeah.
And I was reading back to the thing with the Book of Amos a little bit, where it talks about a man and his father resort to the same girl.
Right.
You know, Judah didn't know that he was consorting with same girl at the time.
No, he didn't.
And if he hadn't been so self-righteous to publicly, quote, out her
humiliate
as a harlot
her.
And humiliate her and call her to be burned to death.
Yes, publicly burned to death.
While she was still pregnant with...
Yes, with a child.
And all that, then people wouldn't have known, if he would have not
been
so public with
yeah.
her sin,
mm-hmm.
then his sin wouldn't have been so public either.
That's true. I think that's true. I kind of believe it. It is very obvious how very public he made her life. And she just threw it back in his face, which I think is wonderful how she did it. But it was still interesting. Any comments or questions? We're ending a little bit early today. Woohoo! Thank you for your time. God give you a good rest of your Shabbat. Thank you for your effort and wisdom upon each one of us. Please help us to learn your ways and do what is good and right. Help us to be wise and not rash. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.